Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on your phone, your tablet, and online at lsj.com.
Current state for Monday here on 90.5 WKAR. Glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. We were discussing the other day how noticeable the influx of Asian students, Chinese students, is here at Michigan State University the other day. 12% of this upcoming freshman class is from China alone. And it turns out we had the chance to speak with MSU President Luana Simon after Friday's trustees meeting with that population in mind. And we asked President Simon whether any part of the 13-14 budget provides for any more programs or the enhancement of existing ones that prepare these students for the American university experience and the rigors of higher education in a second language. She responded that MSU is working along a number of fronts on behalf of foreign students.
Actually, the number of students we're trying to admit from China and international students in general, the number is going to be about the same as it was last year. We've raised the academic standards. We have to think about it in a variety of ways. First of all, we're changing orientation to try to make sure that when they arrive day one, there's a greater expectation to move out of their comfort zone and into the community. When you bring people in a week before everybody else, they're about the only people to talk to. And so it's natural what happened. But we have to recognize that kids from Grand Rapids talk to kids from Grand Rapids that they knew, and kids from Detroit talk to kids from Detroit that they know. So it's not going to be one way or the other. And the second thing we're doing is we've sent a delegation to China to learn more about how things happen there in terms of the structure of the first year of a Chinese university education at the very best places in China, and how we can make a translation for them about why our expectations are either the same or different. And that, I think, will pay great dividends. We've added some for the community. We have, I think, one of the few Mandarin-speaking police officers, because we know that that's a challenge. But I know that when I send a large number of students even to London, where language is not a challenge, rules and law are. You know, so you've got to sort of recognize that this is their study away. And they have some of the same challenges that when we send students to study away. And then we need to sort of continue to listen and work through it. But I would tell you that if you take market demand as a measure, because all of these students are connected back home and share their experiences, because we're a very – it's not like the old days. These kids are talking with their friends back home. They're making recommendations about where to go, just like – students in Michigan do back to their high school or across the country. And, you know, what they're saying about us is that their expectation wasn't that we would be perfect, but that would be a great place to be. And our commitment to them and to all of our students is that we are not perfect. We'll try to be more perfect every day and improve, but we still want to be a great place to be.
Especially interesting given Matt Miller's story in yesterday's Lansing State Journal on the university's approach to state, to out-state and foreign students compared to in-state students. But onward with current state here for Monday as NSA leaker Edward Snowden makes his way from Moscow to what sounds like Cuba or Venezuela today. The debate across the country continues over government transparency and what sorts of things the public should know about its government's actions. Our next guests say the conversation about government transparency and open records at the state and local level is much less robust. They and others contend it is an important one. They point to a study showing Michigan to be one of the least open states in the country. In 2012, We earned a failing grade and was ranked 44th out of 50 states in a state integrity investigation conducted by the Center for Public Integrity, Global Integrity, and Public Radio International. And there are two bills making their way through the state legislature that our guests say will make Michigan's court system even less transparent. Jane Briggs Bunting is the executive director of the Michigan Coalition for Open Government. She's also an attorney, a former Free Press reporter, and the former director of MSU's School of Journalism. Jane, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
And also with us, Patrick Clausen, a former CNN investigative reporter and currently an open government advocate based in Flint. Hi, Pat.
Top of the morning, sir.
Jane Briggs Bunting, who conducted this investigation, and what did it measure exactly?
Well, the Center for Public Integrity and a couple of other members of the consortium did that just to check availability and access to public records, the cost, the time elements involved, and how long it takes when you make a public records request to get it, and what sort of information is exempt. And Michigan, as you can see, did not fare well. And that's one of the reasons Michigan Coalition for Open Government exists. Michigan was one of two states nationally up until this December 2012, that did not have any sort of Freedom of Information group at all. Alaska was the other one.
Okay.
So 48 other states had public access groups that were advocating to make sure that there was transparency and accountability in government. Michigan lacked that.
Pat Clausen, you've been following this for a while. Give us a little bit of your background and your findings with regard to this issue.
Well, I've been an investigative reporter much of my life. I've also worked as a private investigator. I live over in the Flint area, and I work here in Michigan doing process serving and public interest investigations, that sort of thing. When I came to Michigan in 2004 from Washington, D.C., I came back home after spending a lot of years on the East Coast working in big league media. I made my first Freedom of Information Act request. I was working on a book about, believe it or not, public records in Michigan. And I found out that the Department of Management and Budget here keeps a roster of forms that state agencies use. I asked for a copy of that roster of forms, that catalog of forms. I ended up getting called by a detective sergeant at the Michigan State Police Major Case Squad wanting to know why I was requesting records from a government agency, and they wanted to see me in their offices in Lansing right away.
Wow.
It showed to me that there was a real problem in Michigan with the climate of secrecy here. And as I've been working in the state now for the last 9 years, I've discovered that secrecy is a cancer that just permeates almost every level of government in this state. And it's especially bad in the courts.
So it's not a matter of neglect. It is, you would assert it's more conspiratorial than that?
Well, I don't think it's conspiratorial. I think it's just a culture that has taken root here after decades of inattention from the press and from public interest groups. Government officials here seem to believe that they can just conduct whatever business they want to in secret. Take a look at what Governor Snyder is doing now by having employees that are advising him in nonprofits that are off the books of state government and holding these secret skunkwork meetings to talk about education planning. All of this off the books, all of this off the charts with no public accountability. Same kind of thing goes on in the courts here, where secret hearings are held all the time, court files are suppressed, records are closed. We just had a circuit court judge over in Genesee County try to have the records sealed on his paternity case. And I intervened and we stopped and we got those records remaining open to the public.
What's the awareness, Jane Briggs Bunting, of this issue amongst the wider public, and does it ever come up in the legislature?
There's not a lot of awareness in the general public. That's one of the reasons Michigan Coalition for Open Government exists, trying to get people involved in it. A lot of times, I would say at the small local level, a lot of times it's ignorance. The public officials simply don't know what the law is. But the higher you go within the state bureaucracy, the county bureaucracies, and the larger urban areas, they fully well know the law, and they've been aggressively doing everything they can to prevent access, to discourage it. Right now, Michigan's Freedom of Information Act has a 5-business-day requirement for response with an additional 10 business days if the public body requests it. They go, most public entities blow past that deadline repeatedly and with impunity.
Mark, just a year ago, almost a year and a half ago, I helped the Flint Chamber of Commerce put in a Freedom of Information request for bond offering documents, for a bond offering that the city of Flint did to try to bail itself out of insolvency.
Mm-hmm.
They have failed to respond to that even now.
And how is this? Does this get coverage in Flint? Does this development get coverage statewide?
No. Most of the news organizations in Michigan have cut back on their staff so much. There are very few reporters doing any kind of investigative work in Michigan begin with.
There's a real irony to that because FOIA requests often come from media. You would think the media might be on top of this, but there's an irony.
Surprisingly, most FOIA requests in this state come from business groups, not from the press. It's businesses seeking competitive information.
Oh, I see.
And that's now. I mean, the media was much more aggressive at it. Some news organizations still are very aggressive at it. The Free Press, certainly, you know, with the whole Kwame Kilpatrick thing, WXYZ has done a terrific job. In fact, eliminating a justice from the Michigan Supreme Court, Diane Hathaway. They've also been after Wayne County's executive for mismanagement and other concerns there. So the media has done stuff, but there's so few who are capable, and media organizations simply can't afford it. They don't even, and the public bodies know, they absolutely know that they're not going to get pushed. They're not going to get taken to court on it because it's too expensive. And media companies are not going to pay that bill anymore.
You know, Mark, one of the most aggressive groups in the state of Michigan on freedom of information issues for the last several years has been the Michigan Council of Professional Investigators, not the press. The private investigators of Michigan, I'm a member of that organization, have a vested interest in keeping public records open to inspection. Much of the press has just not even been on the radar screen when it comes to fighting these battles before the legislature or the state Supreme Court. The Michigan Press Association, which represents most of the state's major newspapers, plays a very minimal role in any kind of freedom of information fights in this state, much to my lament.
Does this come up in the legislature, though?
Yes, it does come up in the legislature. There's bills that have, you know, come up in the past couple of months. You know, there's a few months in terms of, you know, trying to tighten down the fee thing. Fees became a huge issue a few years ago. In the 1990s, it used to be the lowest paid person in the organization would be the fee charge. Now it's the lowest paid person capable of retrieving the information. That instantly went from the desk clerk to the police chief. At universities, you know, from a secretary, a clerical person, to the general counsel at their hourly rate. And so when you put that kind of price tag on information, public information, that people have already paid for with their taxes, it becomes increasingly outrageous. And I will add to Pat, there's two groups who have done a lot of FOIAing, and one in particular is the Mackinac Center. The Mackinac Center, a nonprofit, has gone after a lot of information, and the Center for Michigan has gone after a lot of information using FOIA.
And Mark, I got to tell you one thing that you ought to be proud of because you're a broadcaster as I am, okay, is I must tell you the Michigan Association of Broadcasters has been at the forefront of many of these freedom of information fights, and they've been a terrific ally in trying to keep information flowing to the public.
Speaking of the legislature, though, you're meeting later today with the State Court Administrator's Office to discuss two bills in the Senate Judiciary Committee. At the moment, you oppose these bills. What would these bills do, and why do you oppose them?
These bills would make the court information, access to court records, far more difficult, far more expensive, and maybe even not available at all. There's a couple of examples here. One is the state is trying to digitize statewide, make e-filing for court records mandatory in from the district court all the way up to the state Supreme Court, a terrific idea. The problem becomes is if you're a non-litigant, litigants can get access, but they're going to have to pay for it. But if you're a non-litigant, simply a member of the public, it's going to cost you, even to look at it online on screen. And there's no clear information now is what those charges are going to be, because the sole discretion for charging for fees for this is going to be left with the Supreme Court and the State Court Administrator's Office. No check, no balance, no legislative oversight. They just, you know, this bill will give the judiciary a carte blanche in charges, which is crazy. The second thing that's going on is there's a proposal to create secret mental health courts in this state, which means someone who's involved in a supposedly nonviolent crime with mental health issues can go in there, plead guilty. Everything's kept secret and quiet. The sentence will be to go through a mental health program of some sort and then to be discharged from it. All of the data, all of the information on this, everything on this, according to the proposed bill, will be kept secret, will be exempt from disclosure from the public. And that's, you know, frankly, If you want to talk mental health, insane.
Mark, let me give you an idea how some of these secret court bills are actually working right now. Last year, the legislature passed a bill for secret courts involving veterans
Yes.
and drug offenders, all right? Literally hours after the Veterans Court Bill was signed into law by Governor Snyder, Saginaw County court officials moved the tried to move the case of a court officer who had been charged with felony crimes. They tried to move it into one of these secret veterans courts to get it off of the public docket so people didn't know. These things breed corruption. Now, in the case of the fees that the state is trying to charge right now on these electronic court systems, they're astronomical. For instance, in Ottawa County, where they're already running one of these pilot electronic filing systems, for a member of the public to check into the court just to check to find out, for instance, what data is set for their case, it cost them $12 to log online and then another $2.50 for every record that they want to look at. So just to check a court date is $14.50. That's ludicrous. And court officials tell me privately they're setting the fees up high because they don't want the public using court records.
Mm. We have discussed, we've had segments on this program involving mental health courts and veterans courts, and generally they have been portrayed as a very progressive idea, an idea whose time has come. But with both of those examples, you are saying there is secrecy involved in record keeping with regard to both of those things. You're not necessarily condemning the idea of a mental health court or a veterans court for those particular purposes. It's just that those are two examples where secrecy and disclosure is just not taking place.
There should not be secrecy in the courts. The courts historically at the federal level, at the state levels, have been the most transparent of the three bodies of government. Further, there's a Michigan law which says the sittings of all courts shall be public. And furthermore, there's a United States Supreme Court decision called Richmond Newspapers versus Virginia that said trials, criminal trials, have to be open because there's a First Amendment right of public access. So for the public to be able to watchdog, you know, that's being totally ignored by these proposals in Michigan and by these other courts that are operating in secret. Certain parts of courts can obviously be secret. You've got a kid involved in a sexual molestation. You know, the court can be closed for that because it could be intimidating, but it's a limited closure. And a transcript is taken, a transcript is kept, and a transcript is released.
We're talking with Pat Clausen and Jane Briggs Bunting about disclosure in Michigan and transparency and open records. Is any part of government already charged with the responsibility of ensuring some level of transparency or openness?
No.
I'll tell you specifically,
a failing grade.
I'm thinking of departments like the Inspector General. I read these accounts occasionally from inspectors general who will reveal mismanagement of one sort or another. So there is an Inspector General's office. But with regard to transparency, nothing is happening, Pat?
Well, there is a bill pending in the legislature right now that's sponsored by Representative Tom McMillan that would create kind of like a FOIA oversight, Freedom of Information and Open Government oversight body in the state government. But that bill has not gone to a vote yet. These hearings are still being held on that. Hopefully we'll see some action when the legislature comes back from its summer recess. That's a good step forward. But what we have to promote in Michigan is a climate and a culture of openness in government. And that does not exist here right now. From the top down, from the Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court to the governor of the state of Michigan on down, there is no openness, there is no candor, no transparency for the citizens in this state. And as a taxpayer, I'm outraged by that. I want to know how these guys are using my money. I want to know how they're taking actions that are going to affect the public. In the case of the state Supreme Court last October, the Michigan State Supreme Court actually issued rules barring the public disclosure of the financial records of the court system of Michigan. Now, the Constitution of the state of Michigan says all financial records of government bodies in this state are open to public inspection. But the Michigan Supreme Court, last October in a rulemaking action, exempted itself from the Michigan state constitution. That is arrogance unbridled.
Patrick Clausen is a former CNN investigative reporter and is currently an open government advocate based in Flint. Jane Briggs Bunting is the executive director of the Michigan Coalition for Open Government. Thanks to both of you for joining us today to talk about government transparency in Michigan.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Texans and Oklahomans don't just clash over football. They also have a long history of battling, sometimes literally, over water. The latest water conflict played out in the Supreme Court. Justices recently ruled that the Tarrant Regional Water District, located in North Texas, cannot divert water from Oklahoma river basins. In a region like the Great Lakes, this case may seem irrelevant, but according to environmental attorney Solis Michelonis, the Great Lakes Basin should take note. Michelonis is a senior attorney at Plunkett Cooney, and he details why the Great Lakes should care about the Supreme Court's decision in his latest article for Crane's Detroit Business. Solis, welcome to Current State.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let's start by discussing how the Supreme Court case came to be. 35 years ago, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas all joined together to sign the Red River Compact. What is that compact?
Well, the compact is basically an agreement among the states on how to divert water. You can imagine that water flows from state to state to state, and there's the potential of states upriver basically blocking the flow to the states downriver, and that was happening especially to Louisiana. So they worked out an agreement. It's basically a compact agreement. The states get together, they draft an agreement, it gets the blessing of Congress, and then it becomes law.
Now, at some point, I guess a lawmaker in Oklahoma blocked out-of-state water sales. How did this move end up being questioned here in the Supreme Court case?
Well, Oklahoma has laws in place that prevent it from transferring water from outside the state to outside buyers. There's a provision in their legislation where you apply for a permit and they can deny those permits. The compact says you have to divert you have to allow so much water to go downriver, but anything over that you can use to your full extent. And they break it up by different basins. And so what happened here was Fort Worth is in this basin that water comes from Oklahoma. They're running out of water because of drought, because of all the population, because of fracking, for a variety of reasons.
Fort Worth is running out of water.
Fort Worth, yeah.
Yeah,
Fort Worth,
Texas,
Arlington, Texas.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Fort Worth and Arlington,
as opposed to Oklahoma. I just wanted to be clear about that.
Great. Yeah, right. And so Oklahoma's got the water, and they're required to allow a certain percentage of that water to go downstream. But anything over that, they get to keep according to their own provisions and statutes. And so what Fort Worth was trying to do, what Tarrant Regional Water District was trying to do, was basically force Oklahoma to sell it water.
And the decision in the Supreme Court, and it played out exactly how? I mean, Oklahoma was found that they were not obligated to sell the water, correct?
That's right. They said under the terms of the compact, Oklahoma was fulfilling its end of the bargain, and that Fort Worth was not, or Tarrant Regional Water District, wasn't allowed to require Oklahoma to divert certain amounts of water to it.
And here in the Great Lakes, why do you feel that that case has particular relevance?
Well, the Supreme Court looked at the language of the compact and held it strictly. They looked at it as if it was a contract, and that's how they interpreted it. Now, the Great Lakes has its own compact, the Great Lakes Compact, with the seven states, Great Lakes states, and the water in the Great Lakes Basin, along with Quebec and Ontario, which are sort of honorary members. They can't bind the Canada, but it's basically a very similar concept where the water in the Great Lakes Basin is required to remain in the Great Lakes Basin with very few exceptions. And so the idea is that if the Supreme Court has taken a look at this Red River Compact and held it strictly, even to the point where, you know, Fort Worth was in a dire situation, they needed the water, and even then the Supreme Court wouldn't allow the water, then if you're living in the Great Lakes Basin, you're concerned about water being diverted outside the basin, you can take a look at this decision and determine that, well, the Supreme Court's probably going to honor our compact as strictly.
Generally a favorable ruling in terms of Michigan,
correct,
its impact on Michigan. Now, the Great Lakes Compact that you referred to has yet to be really tested in relation to water divergence. There is a precedent-setting request right now from a town in Wisconsin, Waukesha, Wisconsin. Explain that situation and how that's unfolding.
Well, there is a provision in the Great Lakes Compact where you can divert water outside the basin, and there's very limited opportunities for this. And you have to be either basically right on the basin line or in a county that is located inside the basin. So you could be a city outside the basin but located in a county that's inside the basin. And Waukesha is one of those cities. And so there's actually a provision in the compact that allows you to do that. Now, to allow those outside diversions, you need the agreement of all seven governors. All seven states need to agree to that diversion.
And where are we on that timeline here exactly?
I haven't followed it that closely, but I've been reading it off and on. I think they're still in the process. Is it going to be likely that the Waukesha is going to get the water? I think if they're in the county, they may. There are already several diversions already outside the Great Lakes Basin that already exist. Probably the largest one is the one that deals with Chicago. That water gets diverted at Chicago into the Mississippi River. So some diversions would be allowed, but again, you know, this is a very limited opportunity for, you know, very specific facts that would allow that sort of diversion. We're not talking about diverting it to, you know, Nebraska or something.
Well, I'm just curious though, as we watch if we were to watch water levels continue to go down in the Great Lakes, would a case like the Waukesha case be more likely to trigger a denial in the future?
It may be, and the water is diverted. I mean, in the Great Lakes, people don't realize it's like 1% of the water is recharged on an annual basis because of rain and snowfall and things like that. So the water levels are pretty static. I mean, the water that's in the Great Lakes is the water that's been there for a very, very long time, and it doesn't get recharged at a very large rate. So, you want to make sure that you hold on to it. Now, Waukesha gets ahead, and then the next person comes in line, asks for it. Diversion, as things get drier, that may happen, and people are nervous about the water levels. You've been reading about it a lot in the papers. Even with all the rain we've had this spring, it really hasn't affected those lake levels at all.
How does this play out west, where a drought is a much bigger problem than it is here in the Midwest?
Well, it's a huge issue out west. I mean, they've had, you know, businesses actually close down because they've run out of water. I know that a couple years ago there was actually a solar plant that was making solar panels and stuff had to close down because it ran out of water. There have been nuclear plants in the southeast that have had to close down because the water is so shallow and so warm they can't use it to cool off the reactor. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot of pressure. People will be looking to the Great Lakes, and they have. I mean, there's been a lot of schemes already in the past where people have attempted to try to divert water. The one that sort of provided the impetus for the compact was in 1998 when some company out of Canada wanted to sell tanker loads of water to an Asian company to ship overseas. So there are going to be pressures like that. There's a very interesting article in this month's Harper magazine about a company trying to take glacier water out of Iceland and putting it on old oil tankers and shipping it to the Mideast and things like that. So
interesting. Wow.
Yeah, so stuff like that is going to be coming up. And you know, one of the things also people don't realize is that drought with climate change and things like that, I mean, a couple of years ago, the Pentagon took a look at what's going to be providing the impetus for future conflicts abroad.
Yeah.
And water is one of the largest ones. I mean, right now, Pakistan and India are fighting over a reservoir. And you know how hot those countries, how much they
already are.
Each other.
Yeah.
So add water to the mix.
Yeah.
And you've got a volatile situation.
Just add water. Solas Michelonis is a senior attorney at Plunkett Cooney. He's practiced environmental law for over 25 years. You can find more of his work on the intersection of law and the environment, Law and the Environment blog for Cranes Detroit. Thanks, Solas.
It's been my pleasure.
This environmental segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news on the Great Lakes environment is available at greatlakesecho.org. Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The concept of microfinance, essentially, Small loans given to entrepreneurs who are too little or too underfunded to qualify for traditional bank loans has exploded in the developing world. Muhammad Yunus, the founder of Bangladesh-based Grameen Bank, one of the microfinance pioneers, won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize for his work. One of the leading online platforms for microfinance is called Kiva, which connects entrepreneurs with interest-free loans offered by members of the local community. Just 2 years ago, with the help of Michigan Core, a Detroit-based nonprofit, Kiva became the first microfinance effort in the United States. Last month, Michigan Core expanded Kiva's platform into Flint to help small businesses seek interest-free loans. Here to tell us more about microfinance in Michigan is Elizabeth Barlow. She's the executive director of Michigan Core. Hi, Elizabeth.
Mark, how are you this morning?
Just great, thank you. Glad to have you along. And with us in the studio, Marcus Beeth, the founder of Mark 3 Graphic Design, one of the first businesses to take part in Kiva's Flint project. Welcome, Marcus.
Hi, how's it going?
Real good. Elizabeth, the Kiva platform started back in 2005, mostly to work with the microfinance industry in the developing world. Tell us a little bit about its history and a little bit more about how it works.
Wonderful. I'd be happy to do that, and thanks for having us on the show today. It's
sure.
Great to be here. So Kiva's platform really is an innovative model in the microfinance space, because essentially what it does is it invites individuals within the community near and far to help be a part of advancing an entrepreneur through a micro loan. As an individual, you can visit the Kiva website, actually read firsthand the story of an entrepreneur who's seeking funding, and contribute to their loan $25 at a time. And so with Michigan Core, what we did is back in June of 2011, actually, we worked with Kiva to help bring their platform to the United States, beginning in Detroit. And then just last month, as you mentioned, we expanded the program to the Flint community alongside Marcus and a few other entrepreneurs.
Marcus, you're one of Kiva's, Flint's first entrepreneurs. How did you connect with them?
I connected with them through a small company called, I'm sure they're not small, but Metro Community Development. I was going to them for a few funding options, and they said that I would be a great candidate for what Kiva was offering.
And tell us about your business.
It's a graphic design studio. I basically specialize in logo design, branding, promotional materials, any sort of thing that I can design digitally. I spent about a decade in the garment industry also, so I specialize in apparel design as well.
And how did the experience, how did the connection with Kiva, what did that lead to?
It's led to a lot of great things, actually a lot of work, believe it or not. I'm getting a lot of loans and, you know, all the funding is coming in fantastically, but I'm also getting work from clients that have stumbled upon the Kiva site and then wanted to contact me for work.
Elizabeth Garlow, how did the Kiva platform go in Detroit? How many businesses did you fund, and what do some of them do?
Well, we've had a whole bunch of businesses go through the platform in Detroit since we've been up and operating there for a couple of years now. We have a community of about 1,000 lenders in the Detroit area that contribute to loans. We funded about 25 businesses that range from home-based graphic designers and service providers like Marcus to retail and restaurant storefront businesses in the city. And really what we're excited about with the Kiva program here in Michigan is the way that it actually helps the community rally around local entrepreneurs. So like Marcus is saying, really is an experience of individuals being able to connect with the story of an entrepreneur and certainly, you know, help contribute to a loan, but also champion them in other ways as customers, as overall advocates for their success.
Marcus, are you still getting your story out to other small business people in the Flint area and telling people about the Kiva platform then?
Absolutely. Everybody that that I've been able to chit-chat with or sell myself to has been an opportunity for me to bring it up, and I bring it up.
And how do they respond when they find out about this opportunity?
They're a little bit questionative at first.
Yeah.
A lot of people think that they're just giving me free money. And basically I just explained it to him, like, it's not really free money. It's just helping me out now, and it's actually a loan where you'll get it back over time.
What's it like instructing people, Elizabeth, about how the Kiva platform works?
Well, what we like to do is invite people to contribute to these loans with really with a reminder that it's something that pays forward, right? So if you contribute to a loan to an entrepreneur in Flint like Marcus, once he repays the loan, you can actually recycle the funds to a new entrepreneur. So it's a loan that keeps on giving. It keeps on advancing other entrepreneurs. And we find that a lot of folks that go and read the stories of entrepreneurs on Kiva here in Michigan actually want to take it a step further, and they want to engage in conversation with that entrepreneur. So what we're able to do actually on the website is once you've made a loan, we actually can invite you into a conversation. You can chat back and forth with the entrepreneur. And in fact, one of our Kiva Flint entrepreneurs has already had 96 different exchanges with her lenders on the conversation platform on her webpage. So she's really looking to connect with and build a community around her business. And we think that's really one of the most fantastic attributes of the site itself.
Marcus, can you tell us how much you've raised?
I believe I'm at about $1,500 right now.
Okay. And what will you use the money for if you're successful?
If I am successful, which I'm almost guaranteed to be, I mean, I'm really getting there. The funds are basically capital that I will be getting later, that I'm getting now, so I can do things like buy a laptop to help out with my business. I can do things like hopefully purchase a 3D printer to increase my opportunities as a graphic designer, things like that.
Elizabeth, how much do we know about the larger impact of this over time? How much promise does this hold, in your opinion?
We think it holds a lot of promise, certainly in terms of advancing entrepreneurs who are creating jobs in their communities, who are really building more density and vibrancy within the community. Marcus is incredibly involved in his Flint community, and so we hosted a launch event for Kiva Flint last month and had a ton of people come out to a local venue to really get engaged and learn how to become involved. And so we think this has a lot of implications for building a strong community fabric in communities around our state, but also has real economic implications. We're talking about businesses. Small businesses are a huge generator of jobs in this country. And so the more we can do to help them get started, get launched, get stabilized with these zero interest loans, the more we can do to help create jobs within our communities.
We're talking with Elizabeth Garlow and Marcus Beath about microfinance here in Michigan and the Kiva platform in particular. Elizabeth, what happens if the business doesn't pay back the loan?
If the business doesn't pay back the loan, first and foremost, we do everything we can to reach out to a business. If they're struggling to make repayments on a loan, we look at what we can do to help connect them with service providers in the community or something that would help stabilize their business and get them back on a path to repaying that loan. But this is really a good faith effort of the community. It's individuals in the community that put their trust into the business. And so if the business doesn't repay, the community doesn't get repaid. But really, it is a good faith effort. The community is getting behind these folks with the hope that they will repay so that, again, they can continue to pay it forward with that loan to other entrepreneurs in the community.
Marcus, it would seem this is a pretty good way to connect with, to actually stir up business amongst other people who become a part of the network, though.
I did just recently finish a job for a client from France that contacted me through Kiva.
Okay. And this is a web dynamic that's in play here, Elizabeth. Is it fair to say that? Is that part of the appeal of this and part of the effect?
We think it's a huge part of the appeal. The internet is changing everything in terms of how we can connect and collaborate with each other. And that's really what Michigan Core is about. We're about giving, we're a global community of Michigan citizens that wants to get involved and re-engage with the state and helping advance positive developments in communities around Michigan. And the internet really helps us to do that. The web creates a platform for us to connect to one another and to connect to folks like Marcus and really make a tangible contribution to his success, regardless of whether we're in France or in California or locally within the Flint community. So we're excited about the ways that the Kiva initiative through Michigan Core is helping Michigan citizens everywhere, people passionate about Michigan, actually feel a real part of its growth and success and vibrancy.
Do you have a third Michigan location in mind that you would like to expand the Kiva platform to?
Well, we've had quite a few communities around the state asking to bring this model to their community, all the way from the very western side of the state to the UP. We really do hope that this does become Kiva, Michigan. We want to bring this model to communities all over the state. The Flint community was really a pioneer in helping us to do that. We were so impressed and excited about the way the Flint community came together. Marcus talked about a local microfinance or a local economic development agency in Flint called Metro Community Development.
Elizabeth, we're gonna have to leave it there. I'm so sorry. We're out of time. Elizabeth Garlow is the executive director of Michigan Corps. Marcus Beath is the founder of Mark III Graphic Design, one of the first businesses to take part in Kiva's Flint project. Thanks to both of you. You're listening to Current State here on WKAR. For 40 years, Walter and Elsa Verdere have made up two-thirds of the Verdere Trio. They've been joined by a number of pianists over the years. Sylvia Roederer has been the third member the last 15 years. On Tuesday night, they'll celebrate four decades together with a concert at MSU's Wharton Center. During that time, their repertoire has included hundreds of pieces that were specially commissioned for violin, clarinet, and piano. Current State Scott Pohl spoke with the Verderes about their work and their plans for this week's concert.
Well, it all started, actually, of course, when Walter and I met here at MSU and then got married. And we got married in 71. And 72 was really our first season, 72, 73. And we'd already played some of the major works, like by Bartok, by Stravinsky, and then there's several others. But we soon realized that if we wanted to continue to do this, we'd have to start commissioning, which we did. And now we've gotten, in all those 40 years, well over 200, I think about 225 up to 250. I have to count one day. And Walter has largely been in charge of all the commissioning. I kind of started it out because he was sort of a 19th century man. But he soon became a 20th century man. And he's wonderful on the phone. And he can talk to any composer, and rich or famous or whatever. Whereas I always feel a little intimidated. So he's terrific at that. And we represent this collection of works, represents really sort of all the major styles and trends of the end of the last century and the beginning of this century. So, and it's been purposefully so too. We have our avant-garde music, but we also have a great number of pieces that are very accessible and very lovely, many of which we're playing on the Wharton Center concert. So I hope people will come. We tried to pick our very favorites, movements of our very favorite pieces, to just show the variety and sort of kind of showcase our favorite pieces.
MSU has been very helpful to us. And it started in the early 80s when I went to see at that time he was provost, John Cantlin, or vice president for development. And I asked him for help in getting some funding to commission important composers. Because, you know, you do have to apply for funding. And he was interested in the idea. So he was helpful, and he continued that. And he introduced me then to Luana Simon when she became assistant or associate provost. And she also continued to help with our funding. We have gotten funding from outside also, and many composers have written for us just because they want to.
I wanted to ask you about how you approach a composer for a new piece. What sorts, if any, of guidelines do you give them? We would like a thematic design on a piece. We would like to emphasize the clarinet for a piece. No guidelines at all. How do you approach composers?
In all those ways, because you know, some composers are approachable. Some of the older and very well-known composers, you really don't want to suggest anything to them, except Joan Tower said that when I asked her to write for us, I asked for certain things, like that she shouldn't put the clarinet and violin in unison for a long time because somebody had just done that. I mean, we do occasionally do that. And when it's a younger composer, sometimes we suggest an idea. Often with a composer from Tasmania, I suggested to him it would be wonderful if his piece could kind of be a tone poem about the Tasmanian devil. And he liked that idea.
He had seen some of those at the zoos, and they're ferocious. Yes. So go ahead.
So he liked that idea, and that acted as a kind of spark, and it inspired him. And the piece is beautiful.
And then I've asked composers, if possible, not to use the extreme high register of the clarinet. Some composers seem to delight in it. One of them said, I like the strained sound of it. Well, I don't. I think the clarinet's a gorgeous instrument, particularly in the low register. And I've said, try not to forget that low register. I have said that. I've also said, don't dwell too long for it, too high. And if possible, end the piece loud. It never hurts to end the piece loud. But many of them don't. It got to be a real fad for a while to end softly.
Yeah. Yes,
now it's
50-50. Softly.
Yes.
Do composers now approach you? I've written a piece for trio. I need an outlet for it to get it out there. Does that happen?
Yes. Many composers have approached us and given us their pieces. And most of the time, I mean, we're interested in seeing them and delighted that they wrote them. But actually, we have a backlog always of pieces that we have to learn ourselves. And because we commissioned them, yeah. And agreed to play them, you know. And so we usually have to say, well, if we get to it. But so it's, we're usually just overbooked.
Well, actually, for many years, we would do 8 to 10 premieres a year of pieces written for us. So that was really about all we could handle.
What has the Verdere Trio meant to some of these composers? I'm envisioning that for some, it's been the launching pad to a career or something along that line for some of the composers. Can you touch on what your work has meant to some of the composers?
I think, in general, composers are very aware of what we have done. And whether we've launched any careers, I just don't know. Would you?
I think
might have helped.
Often, with the younger composers, you know, it's been helpful to them to be asked by us and to have their pieces recorded, because then they get reviews in national magazines, the American Record Guide and Fanfare and Strad Magazine often, and other publications will review their music then. So that's helpful. And with some of the important composers who have written for us, and I would mention Alan Hovhaness and Ned Roram, for example, and Peter Schickele, there, and Arutunian also, and Menotti. I think their pieces, I mentioned those pieces because they have really caught on and they're being played a lot, and so that's very important for. Even for a famous composer, you know, is to have works in circulation that become part of the accepted repertoire. And there are other wonderful works that have been played a lot. The Balcom has been played a lot, too.
What are your plans for the celebration concert at the Wharton Center?
Well, again, we're trying to do a survey of some of our most favorite pieces. We're presenting a premiere by a young Spanish composer, Octavio Vázquez. That's really a very exciting and very attractive piece, and he'll be at the concert. And then we're also doing two movements of William Balcom's trio, which is just a wonderful work. He's such an imaginative, brilliant composer.
And we're ending with the Arutunian, the last two movements, because, as I say, it's what people really have liked.
Thank you.
we're beginning with a piece called Dash, which is 4.5 minutes of just pretty rapid-fire 16th notes.
The James Hartway 5 postcards from Michigan. Then we're doing 3 of them. The first one's Beaumont Tower, the Carillon. And the second one is Sleeping Bear Dunes. And the third one, Tequamanum Falls.
That we won't discuss. We want them to be surprised, whomever is in the audience. But it's by Jim Niblock with references to MSU in other ways.
I know what it is, but I won't tell. Walter Verdaere and Elsa Verdaere, so much fun to spend some time with you. Congratulations on 40 years together with the Verdaere Trio, and good luck at the Wharton Center.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much. We enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. We're back tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for listening.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com.